So if you break your arm, the ER doctor basically points to this jagged white line on an X-ray and says, "Well, there it is."
Right, it's completely binary, broken or not broken.
Exactly. You cast it, you heal, you move on with your life. But I mean, you step out of the ER and into the rest of your life, and suddenly that precision just kind of vanishes.
Yeah, the real world is incredibly messy.
It really is. Have you ever felt like you are doing everything, quote unquote, right? Eating the vegetables, forcing yourself to the gym, downloading all those sleep trackers, and you still wake up feeling like you've run a marathon in your sleep?
Or, maybe you've sat in a clinic and listened to standard medical advice, and you're thinking about your daily schedule, your bank account, your neighborhood.
And realizing the doctor is asking you to do something that is literally physically impossible for you.
That gap, that massive gap between the clinical advice and your lived reality, is exactly what we are exploring today.
Welcome to this deep dive. Today, we are taking a highly tailored journey into, honestly, a fascinating 2026 white paper by Dr. Bechara Saheeli.
Yeah, it's titled The Field of Viability Framework, a relational life course model of health, well-being, and collective action. It's a bit of a mouthful, but the concepts are
Groundbreaking. The mission for this conversation is to really break down this radical new framework that explains the biological mechanisms behind that exhaustion we just talked about.
right. It completely dismantles this outdated idea that you are just an isolated biological machine operating in a vacuum.
We are mapping a brand new diagnostic grammar to understand how the outside world literally, physically crosses your boundaries to become your biology.
And, moving beyond just complaining about the current healthcare system, this paper actually offers a functional language to replace the parts of the biomedical model that are, frankly, actively failing us.
Right, especially when it comes to chronic complex conditions. So let's unpack this. To understand this new framework, we first have to look at the massive success story of modern medicine.
Because it is a success story. It saves millions of lives.
Absolutely. But that very success has created this profound blind spot. Think of the traditional biomedical model less like a mechanic fixing a car and more like a highly specialized botanist.
Okay, I like this analogy.
Right. So this botanist can study the internal vascular system of a single leaf under a microscope with breathtaking precision. They can identify a tiny cellular blockage and inject water directly into the leaf's veins, but they completely refuse to look at the root system.
Or the soil pH, or the fact that the entire forest is in the middle of a 10-year drought.
Exactly. The leaf turns brown, they inject the water, the leaf turns brown again, and the botanist concludes, well, the leaf simply has a defective vascular system.
Which perfectly captures the triumphs and the limitations of modern biomedicine.
Yeah.
I mean, the model is built on these disciplined reductions.
Right, breaking things down.
Yeah. We link a symptom to an organ, then the organ to a tissue, the tissue to a cell, and the cell to a specific molecular pathway.
And if you have a ruptured appendix or like a severe bacterial infection, that reductionist precision is a miracle.
Oh, it's morally indispensable. It excels at acute, localizable problems.
Because if my appendix bursts, I do not want the surgeon pausing to discuss the sociological landscape of my neighborhood.
No, please just extract the inflamed tissue immediately.
Right. But where biomedicine hits a wall is when it deals with conditions that refuse to present as single localizable failures.
Which is most of what we deal with now. We are talking about multimorbidity.
And for the listener, multimorbidity is simply when a person suffers from two or more long-term health conditions simultaneously.
Like having arthritis, depression, and heart disease all at once.
Yeah, things like type 2 diabetes, autoimmune disorders, chronic pain, systemic burnout.
Those do not emerge from a single broken part. They emerge as these really complex patterns across intersecting biological systems over long stretches of time.
A model built for a sudden injury simply cannot solve a chronic field-generated problem. Like a pill can force your blood vessels to dilate to lower your blood pressure.
But the pill cannot alter the chronic financial insecurity or the lack of safe walking infrastructure that's keeping your nervous system in a state of high alert in the first place.
Which brings us to the core reframing of this paper. The framework argues that the concept of the quote-unquote isolated individual is basically a myth.
An abstraction. It doesn't exist. No human being develops outside of a relationship, and no physical body is untouched by housing policy, ecology, or history.
The true unit of health, according to Dr. Saheeli, is not the isolated individual body, it's the developing person in field.
Yes. You do not enter a clinic. as a detached organism. You bring a sprawling biography into that exam room.
You bring your family system, your economic reality.
A history of psychological trauma or protection, your ecological environment. The paper actually uses the word constitutive to describe the field.
Constitutive. So it's not just a background.
Exactly. The environment isn't a painted backdrop you stand in front of. It is the raw material that literally builds and regulates your biology.
It shapes what you perceive, how your nervous system regulates energy.
And what behavioral options are actually physically available to you.
But when we operate under the isolated individual model, treating people like brains floating in jars, it leads to this massive amount of moralizing.
Because if the environment is invisible to the doctor, the only variable left to blame is the patient's willpower.
That is the tragic consequence of the reductionist model. Suffering gets translated into personal failure.
A patient diagnosed with type 2 diabetes is told they have a poor diet or they lack discipline.
Or someone with hypertension is labeled non-compliant with their meds.
Or we tell a patient to just reduce their stress levels to help their autoimmune condition, entirely omitting the reality that they work two unpredictable shift jobs and live under the constant threat of eviction.
The field vanishes from the diagnostic code.
And the individual absorbs total responsibility for biological constraints they didn't even create.
But wait, let me play devil's advocate here. If we accept that the field is heavily responsible for these biological outcomes, does that framework erase our personal agency?
That's a really common pushback.
Because if someone's environment is dictating their cellular responses, it would be really easy to assume there's no point in them trying to cook a healthy meal or go for a walk.
Right. But the person in field model rigorously avoids that trap of structural determinism. It refuses to blame you for field-generated harm while simultaneously preserving your lived agency.
Okay, how does that work in practice?
Well, agency is real, but it is deeply field-dependent. Your capacity to make a choice relies on the margins, the perceptual clarity, and the actual options your environment affords you right then.
So if you are chronically sleep-deprived, financially drained, and living in a food swamp,
your biological agency is severely constrained. Your brain is prioritizing immediate survival and caloric density, not long-term health planning.
But conversely, if you are rested, socially supported, and have easy access to fresh food, your agency is vastly expanded.
Exactly. The framework distributes responsibility. You possess agency within your constraints, but institutions, governments, and commercial systems possess the responsibility for designing the fields that either expand or crush that agency.
It's acknowledging the specific physics of the game board you are standing on, rather than just yelling at the player for how they roll the dice.
That's a great way to put it.
So if the field is actually a part of us, our entire definition of health needs a serious upgrade. It can't just mean the absence of a diagnosable disease.
Right, because someone could walk into a clinic with perfect lab results, a resting heart rate of 60, flawless cholesterol.
But they might be one missed paycheck away from eviction. Or they're acting as the sole caregiver for a parent with dementia and haven't slept more than 4 consecutive hours in 3 years.
Their labs look healthy on paper, but they are on the verge of biological collapse.
So what does this all mean for how we define health?
The framework shifts the goalposts from normality to viability. Health is defined as the life course viability of the developing person in field.
Viability. The living capacity of a person to continue, recover, develop, relate, participate, and flourish under shifting conditions.
Let's actually trace how those dimensions of viability look in a person's life.
Yeah, let's do an example. Imagine a freelance graphic designer living in a major city. Their baseline viability starts with continuity.
Which is just keeping the engine running, preserving basic life functions, safety, bodily integrity.
Right, they have a roof over their head, they can afford groceries. But then a disturbance hits. Let's say their landlord raises the rent by 30%.
Okay, that disturbance immediately tests the second dimension, which is recovery. Can this person return from the shock without their system collapsing?
If they have financial savings, which is a margin mainframe, they can absorb the rent hike while looking for a new apartment.
But if they lack that margin, the shock threatens their continuity. The stress hormone cortisol spikes, disrupting their sleep architecture.
And without sleep, the third dimension development completely stalls.
Because viability isn't just surviving, it's growing your capacities over time.
If our designer is exhausted, they literally can't learn the new software required to get better paying clients. Their cognitive development is halted by the rent increase.
Which then forces them to isolate themselves to work much longer hours, which damages the fourth dimension. relationship.
And a viable human being needs to belong, attach, and co-regulate with others.
If they're working 80 hours a week to cover rent, they miss social gatherings. They lose the biological buffer of human connection.
Survival without relationship is a severely compromised form of viability. And as that isolation sets in, we see the erosion of the fifth dimension, agency.
Right. They stop perceiving new opportunities. They feel trapped, just enduring the world rather than acting upon it.
Which completely eliminates any possibility for the final dimension, which is flourishing. There's no meaningful expansion of life capacity. They're just trying to keep their head above water.
This cascade shows how a single environmental shift, a rent increase, systematically dismantles a person's viability across all six dimensions.
It's wild to think about it that way. And Dr. Sackley distills this into a profound ethical anchor called the life capacity test.
Because viability is the ultimate goal, the paper argues we should judge every health intervention, commercial product, or public policy by one unyielding criterion.
Does it preserve and expand life capacity, or does it disable it?
Exactly.
You could apply that diagnostic test to a new social media algorithm, a new municipal zoning law, or a new pharmaceutical drug.
It's a universal metric.
But, you know, having a grand philosophy of health is great. But how does a doctor or a city planner actually use it?
That's where we get to the practical tools.
Right, because we've heard the term social determinants of health for years.
Mm-hmm.
Housing, income, education. But knowing those things matter doesn't tell a doctor what to do in a 15-minute consultation.
Yeah, social determinants were a crucial corrective to the biomedical model, proving health happens outside the hospital. But currently, we just use them as a scattered vocabulary list.
Like, we know poverty and pollution are bad words, but without grammar, you can't build a sentence. You can't explain how the variables dynamically interact.
And that's why Dr. Saheeli introduces the seven primitives. They serve as this functional grammar.
Here is where it gets really interesting. Let's look at how this grammar constructs a physical reality. Instead of treating these seven primitives as a checklist, let's watch them chain together.
Let's use a clinical example.
Okay, we'll start with a patient sitting in a clinic. The doctor takes a blood pressure reading. It's 160 over 100. That reading is the primitive we call state.
State is the objective current condition of the system. State is vital. We need to know the reality of the hypertension.
But why is the state abnormal?
The elevated blood pressure is a symptom of the next primitive, regulation.
The body is organizing a response.
Yeah, exactly. The cardiovascular system is intentionally constricting blood vessels and retaining sodium. But regulation doesn't happen in a vacuum. The body is regulating in response to the next primitive, which is a disturbance.
What is perturbing the system? In this case, the disturbance isn't a physical tiger chasing them.
No, the disturbance is chronic noise pollution from a highway constructed 50 feet from their bedroom window, combined with the stress of an insecure job.
But wait, how does the cardiovascular system know about the job or the highway?
That requires the primitive of perception. Perception is how the situation is sensed, interpreted, or misread by the nervous system.
So the sound of the highway isn't just a decibel reading on a machine.
No. The brain's amygdala interprets that relentless low-frequency rumble as a continuous ambient threat. The nervous system perceives an unsafe environment and signals the regulatory system to prepare for danger.
But why does this specific disturbance cause such a dramatic shift in state for this person? Because of the next primitive, margins.
Margins are the buffers, the redundancies, the savings accounts of our biological and social systems.
If this person had the margin of profound restorative sleep or the financial margin to install soundproof windows, the disturbance of the highway wouldn't overload their system.
But modern environments systematically erode margins. We run our biology like lean corporate supply chains. So when the margin is zero, even a minor disturbance causes an immediate crisis.
The erosion of margins is usually driven by the next primitive, constraints. What limits viable action?
A constraint can be material, like systemic poverty preventing the person from moving away from the highway.
But constraints can also be life-enabling, right?
Absolutely. If a municipality passes a law limiting truck traffic on that highway at night, that is a regulatory constraint on commerce that drastically improves the viability of the residents.
Which leaves the final primitive, options. What actual pathways exist for protection or repair?
Right. If a doctor tells his patient, you need to reduce your stress and get better sleep to lower your blood pressure, but the patient's constraints keep them trapped near the disturbance.
Their options are essentially zero. Giving medical advice that a patient has no options to execute is an illusion of care.
It's coercive, honestly. The seven primitive state, regulation, disturbance, perception, margins, constraints, and options allow a practitioner to diagnose the field, not just the body.
So if you view a determinant like housing through this grammar, it ceases to be a static fact.
Housing is a constraint if it's unaffordable. It is a margin if it provides a safe place to recover. It is a disturbance if it's filled with toxic mold.
It dictates perception by making a person feel either secure or deeply ashamed.
Exactly. The grammar moves us from basic description to actionable, multi-layered diagnosis.
We now have this grammar to read the environment, but the most radical claim of the deep dive material is its explanation of embodiment.
This is where it gets really profound.
Because the field, the moldy housing, the poverty, the relentless noise, it doesn't stay outside the skin. It crosses the boundary and structurally alters the cells.
The field literally becomes your biology.
I want to dig into the mechanisms here. Isn't this just a fancy way of saying stress is bad for you? Mm. If I have a micromanaging boss or a busy highway, how does that actually alter human tissue?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the concept of embodiment argues that the body is continually field carrying.
Field carrying?
Yes. The nervous system and the immune system are essentially environmental listening devices, constantly reorganizing energy and cellular architecture based on what they hear.
And the paper details specific biological pathways where this translation occurs. The first is the neuroendocrine and autonomic pathway, which introduces the mechanism of allostatic load.
Let's track the mechanics of allostatic load because it's crucial.
Okay, so when a person faces an immediate threat, say swerving to avoid a car accident, the sympathetic nervous system activates.
The hypothalamus sends a signal to the adrenal glands. Cortisol and adrenaline flood the bloodstream.
The heart rate accelerates to pump oxygen to the muscles, the pupils dilate, and glucose is dumped into the blood for immediate energy.
This is a highly adaptive, life-saving regulation. The body handles the disturbance. The threat passes, and the parasympathetic nervous system engages to calm everything down and replenish the spent margins.
That is the system functioning perfectly under acute stress. But consider what happens when the threat is chronic.
What if the threat isn't a swerving car, but systemic discrimination, ongoing domestic abuse, or the persistent threat of eviction?
The field demands continuous mobilization. The body is forced to prioritize short-term survival over long-term tissue repair.
The HPA axis, the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, becomes persistently activated. Cortisol levels remain elevated.
And chronic cortisol is incredibly toxic to tissue over time.
Oh, exactly. The vascular system is constantly constricted, leading to micro tears in the arterial walls. The body patches those tears with cholesterol, forming plaques.
And the brain actually changes too, right?
Yes. The hippocampus, the part of the brain responsible for memory and contextualizing fear, literally begins to shrink under the deluge of cortisol,
making the nervous system even more hypervigilant and rigid.
The wear and tear generated by this relentless regulatory effort is allostatic load. The field has literally become the tension and the plaque in the blood vessels.
The environment acts as the architect of the cardiovascular system. That is wild. The second pathway involves the immune inflammatory system.
We usually think of the immune system as an internal army fighting off foreign invaders like viruses.
But the paper argues it also responds to social and ecological signals.
The immune system manages the boundary between self and the world. It utilizes macrophages and cytokines to signal danger.
So if a person breathes in particulate matter from a heavily polluted neighborhood, or consumes an ultra-processed diet,
or experiences profound social isolation, the immune system interprets that field data as tissue damage or impending danger. It upregulates inflammatory signaling.
It literally treats a social threat like a physical infection.
Yes, and chronic low-grade systemic inflammation is the precursor to a vast array of conditions. Asthma, cardiovascular disease, autoimmune disorders, and even depression.
Wait, depression?
Yeah. The cytokines cross the blood-brain barrier and alter neurotransmitter function, inducing sickness behavior like lethargy and social withdrawal.
Which we often diagnose purely as a psychiatric condition, ignoring the inflammatory driver entirely.
We completely miss the field.
This links directly to the metabolic and mitochondrial pathways. Mitochondria are the powerhouses of the cell, but they are also environmental sensors.
They decide how to allocate energy based on the field's constraints.
Consider the mechanism of insulin resistance. In a field characterized by high stress, sleep deprivation, and a food swamp saturated with cheap, high-fructose food,
the body receives conflicting, chaotic signals. The stress signals tell the body it is in danger and needs to hoard energy.
The mitochondria sense the massive influx of simple sugars, but also sense the oxidative stress from the cortisol and the lack of sleep.
So to protect the cell from being destroyed by too much reactive oxygen, the cell downregulates its insulin receptors. It essentially locks the door to prevent more sugar from entering.
So the sugar just stays in the blood, leading to high blood glucose.
And we view insulin resistance as a broken metabolism. But from the perspective of the cell, it is a brilliant protective adaptation to a corrupted environment.
It is hoarding energy in fat tissue to survive what it perceives as an endless crisis. The metabolic disorder is the embodied expression of a commercial food system that extracts biological margins for profit.
The field is manipulating energy allocation at the subcellular level. It's terrifying, but fascinating.
And the paper also highlights the microbiome. Even the inside of our bodies is an ecology.
The trillions of microbes in our gut are heavily involved in synthesizing neurotransmitters like serotonin.
But urbanization, the loss of green spaces, widespread antibiotic use, and chronic stress, they drastically reduce microbial diversity.
Your gut is literally carrying the depleted ecology of the modern outside world, which in turn dysregulates your digestion and your mood.
Finally, there is the pathway of interoception and behavior. Interoception is how you consciously sense your internal bodily state.
And the framework totally reframes pain and fatigue here. Chronic fatigue isn't necessarily a structural lesion or a failure of willpower.
It is a viability signal. It is the nervous system throwing the emergency brake because the capacity to recover is severely impaired.
This completely changes how we view quote-unquote unhealthy behaviors.
Right, because when a body is regulating under a highly disturbing field with fully depleted margins, behaviors like smoking, substance use, or binge eating are not mere choices made by a weak-willed individual.
Taking a drag of a cigarette provides an immediate, albeit temporary, parasympathetic regulation to a nervous system in extreme distress.
It is an embodied, desperate adaptation to forcefully regulate an unviable field. So what happens when these embodiment pathways are constantly hammered by harmful field conditions?
The primitives we talked about earlier, they start to cascade. Dr. Saheeli calls this the dysregulation loop.
I picture this like a cascading software failure on a computer network. You start with a minor constraint, say, a lack of memory. That glitch overloads the processor.
The overheating processor distorts how the thermal sensors perceive the temperature.
Right. The fans spin out of control, which is maladaptive regulation. This drains the battery, representing a massive loss of margin.
Suddenly, the system has fewer options to save data. The state worsens, and eventually, the entire operating system crashes.
The biological version of that software crash is the pathway to chronic disease. Let's trace the dysregulation loop using the example of childhood asthma.
In the standard biomedical model, childhood asthma is viewed strictly as a lung pathology. The bronchioles are inflamed and constricting.
The clinical response is just to prescribe a corticosteroid inhaler to suppress the inflammation.
But if we run that through the dysregulation loop, the asthma is a field-mediated vulnerability.
Let's start with a constraint. The child's family faces systemic poverty and cannot afford housing outside of a highly industrialized zone.
This constraint forces exposure to a disturbance. Chronic diesel exhaust from a nearby truck route, compounded by toxic mold in the apartment.
Because the family lacks the margin of financial wealth to remediate the mold or move, the child's immune system experiences overload.
The continuous exposure distorts the immune system's perception. It becomes hypersensitized, reading even minor allergens as severe threats.
This drives maladaptive regulation. The immune system mounts a massive inflammatory response in the airways.
And that chronic inflammation leads to further margin loss. The child's physiological reserve drops.
They miss school, losing cognitive and social margins. The parents miss work to care for the child, losing financial margins.
Their options narrow. The worsening state is the acute asthma attack that lands them in the emergency room.
And that new state creates further constraint, perhaps a massive medical bill that deepens the initial poverty.
The lungs are simply the precise physical location where housing policy, commercial transit routes, and structural inequality converge and materialize as biological tissue damage.
If the clinical intervention only provides the inhaler and sends the child back into the moldy apartment on the truck route, the field will perpetually generate the disease.
Exactly. Let's apply the loop to mental distress as well.
The framework argues that depression and anxiety are not simply private, isolated chemical imbalances in the brain.
They are profound dysregulations of perception and meaning. The brain is certainly involved, but the brain is responding to a world that feels biologically and socially unviable.
Consider a young adult navigating the modern digital field. The disturbance is the continuous capture of attention by algorithms.
Algorithms designed to maximize engagement through outrage or curated perfection.
This disturbance actively destroys the margin of sleep. The sleep deprivation and the constant social comparison distort perception.
The nervous system perceives a world of immense threat, social inadequacy, and isolation.
The maladaptive regulation is the withdrawal from physical community to spend more time seeking dopamine through the very screens that are causing the disturbance.
The options for real-world connection narrow. The state of isolation worsens, and that worsening state constrains their ability to envision a viable future.
The depression is an embodied response to an environment that has eroded the shared horizon. But, you know, this dysregulation loop doesn't happen overnight.
No, it happens across a timeline. In this framework, time is not just the background. Time is actually part of your medicine.
The paper refers to this as the life course architecture of viability. It's genuinely bizarre how the clinical model often treats adults as if they popped into existence fully formed at age 35.
Right. It's like turning on a complex video game, loading a character at level 40, and completely ignoring the massive amount of save data that character accumulated during the previous 39 levels.
All the damage taken from enemies, the armor acquired, the skills learned, it is all permanently written into the code of the save file. We act like today's high blood pressure reading exists independently of a 30-year save file.
The save data metaphor brilliantly illustrates how viability is built, strained, and transmitted. Your body carries the accumulated history of its field interactions.
A disturbance occurring during a sensitive developmental window has vastly different physiological consequences than that exact same disturbance occurring in late adulthood.
The framework breaks this architecture into distinct stages, beginning before a person is even conceived, preconception, and intergenerational conditions.
The idea that my health trajectory started before I existed is staggering.
It is biological reality. Epigenetics shows us how environmental pressures modify gene expression without changing the underlying DNA code.
A person inherits a starting configuration. They inherit constraints, like the physiological markers of historical trauma, generational poverty, or parental exposure to chemicals.
However, they also inherit capabilities and margins. Cultural wisdom, community resilience, and ecological stewardship.
The biological viability of a newborn is inextricably linked to the field their parents navigated for decades prior to the pregnancy.
We then move into infancy, and the paper highlights a neurobiological fact that carries massive societal implications.
Yeah.
Human babies are not self-regulating organisms.
They are entirely reliant on co-regulation. An infant cannot soothe its own nervous system or regulate its own heart rate effectively.
The caregiver's physical touch, the rhythm of their heartbeat, the tone of their voice. The caregiver is the infant's regulatory field.
The infant learns to build its own internal regulatory pathways by repeatedly borrowing the caregiver's calm.
This makes you think about the systemic pressures placed on parents, doesn't it?
Absolutely. If a society forces caregivers back to exhausting, precarious work just weeks after birth, or if the caregiver is overwhelmed by poverty and stress,
their own nervous system is dysregulated. They cannot offer the calm baseline the infant needs to borrow.
A society that abandons its caregivers is permanently wiring the nervous systems of the next generation for chronic vigilance.
As we transition into childhood and adolescence, the focus shifts to expanding margins. Play, physical safety, and secure learning environments build those redundancies.
But as we discussed with mental distress, the digital environment has become an unprecedented disturbance during this sensitive window.
Adolescence is when identity and future orientation are biologically programmed to solidify. Mediating that development through commercial algorithms is a massive, unregulated field experiment.
And then adulthood becomes the stage where the saved data truly catches up with you. Adulthood is a collision.
It is the convergence of your accumulated vulnerabilities, the epigenetic markers, the childhood co-regulation deficits, and the highest field demands of your life.
Career pressures, financial obligations, caring for both children and aging parents. This is where the dysregulation loop tightens and surfaces as chronic disease.
And finally, elderhood tests the ultimate endurance of the accumulated margins.
Frailty is not a sudden onset. It is the gradual, systemic reduction of physical and cognitive reserves.
But the viability framework also challenges us to view elderhood through an ethical lens. A viable society organizes systems of reciprocity.
It integrates the wisdom of elders rather than isolating them and viewing their biological dependency with cultural shame. Interdependence is a requirement at every stage.
So we have mapped the breakdown of viability across time, space, and society. The diagnostic picture is clear. But how do we actually heal?
Here is a practical challenge for you, the listener. If I am sick right now, if my heart is failing, I still want the pill or the surgery. Does this entire framework just tell me to go fix global capitalism and hug a tree?
This raises an important question, and Dr. Saheeli is explicit in addressing it. This framework does not reject biomedicine.
Curing pathology is absolutely essential. If you have a fully occluded coronary artery, you require a stent.
The framework relies on the state-of-the-art technical precision of those interventions. The critical distinction is that symptom suppression is not the same as healing.
Healing is the restoration of viable coupling between you and your field. It is reestablishing the capacity to continue, recover, and flourish.
Actionable healing requires intervention on multiple levels. Step one remains clinical care, which is a profound social repair system.
Good care stabilizes the critical state and protects margins. But the framework demands that clinical care also practice quaternary prevention.
Quaternary prevention is the ethical imperative to protect patients from the harms of over-medicalization and institutional violence.
It requires a clinician to recognize when a prescribed medical intervention might actually deplete a patient's margins further.
For example, ordering a cascade of highly expensive, low-yield diagnostic tests that plunge an underinsured patient into medical debt.
The financial constraint generated by the medical bill will cause far more biological dysregulation than the remote pathology the tests were trying to rule out.
Exactly. Step two is looking upstream at condition-generating systems. To achieve true healing, society must stop the field from endlessly generating the disease.
We must hold commercial systems accountable for their biological externalities.
Ultra-processed food conglomerates, technology platforms designing addictive algorithms, chemical industries releasing endocrine disruptors.
These are engines that systematically extract biological margins from the population to generate corporate profit.
Healing at scale means redesigning these fields through public policy so that the environments are life-enabling.
And step three is disease without blame. We must remove the individual moral shame of being sick, but we do not erase responsibility. We distribute it accurately.
A patient is no longer blamed for failing to follow a care plan that their physical constraints make impossible.
But the institutions, the urban planners, the commercial entities, and the governments are held directly responsible for the viability of the fields they control.
The framework fundamentally changes the clinical question. It replaces why did this individual fail with what specific configuration of constraints, disturbances, and depleted margins produced this biological trajectory.
We have covered an immense paradigm shift today. To summarize the core insight, you are not an isolated biological entity walking through a neutral backdrop.
You are a developing person in field. Your health cannot be measured merely by the absence of pathology.
Your health is your life course viability. It is the living, breathing capacity of your daily interactions with food systems, housing, relationships, ecology, and the accumulated saved data of your own history.
We now have a precise grammar, the seven primitives, to diagnose exactly where those interactions are breaking down.
And we recognize that to truly heal, we have to restore the coupling between our physical bodies and our physical world.
I'll leave you with one final thought from the paper based on the concept of the civil commons.
The civil commons are the shared infrastructures that enable life capacity without reducing every human need to a commodity exchange.
Clean municipal water, accessible public parks, trustworthy independent science, universal health care, secure housing. These are the invisible foundations of your biological viability.
Without them, your body has to spend massive amounts of energy regulating against the environment.
Think deeply about your own daily trajectory. What are the shared life infrastructures you rely on to maintain your health that you do not personally own?
When you evaluate your personal field today, which of the seven primitives is quietly draining your margins, forcing your mitochondria to hoard energy, and pushing your nervous system toward dysregulation without you even noticing?
It is incredibly easy to feel a sense of personal failure when the muddy waters of exhaustion and chronic illness are rising around you.
But perhaps the X-ray machine and the blood test aren't the only diagnostic tools available anymore. Now we have a map to read the water itself. Thank you for taking this profound deep dive with us today. Look around your neighborhood, examine the constraints of your own routine, and start seeing the world through the grammar of viability. Until next time.